This next one's called Devil Do.
Okay, so I'm at a party. Well, not exactly a party. I'm at one of those literary events where a bunch of authors read their work, talk for a while, then there's free wine at the end of it. During the free wine portion of the event, I got into a conversation with a creative writing teacher who was telling me about an online class she had started teaching. She said, some of the students are amazing, but others just write about landing gear and space battles, and I don't know what to do with those stories. I mean, I write literary fiction. I wanted to shout at her, what's not literary about science fiction? Some of the greatest writers of all time write science fiction. Margaret Atwood, Ursula K. Le Guin, Jonathan Lethem. And does daring to imagine a new world suddenly strip a work of its literary merit? And who died and made you the queen of deciding what's literary anyway? Of course I didn't say that. I politely nodded and found someone else to talk to. But her words kept on bothering me. I grew up on science fiction. The first grown-up books I read were science fiction. I would raid my dad's collection, and when I was finished, I would go to the bookstore and come home with my arms stuffed with all the books I could carry. I loved reading about all the potential futures. They made me imagine in ways I never imagined before. They made me ask questions I never asked before. So in this episode, I want to look at science fiction all around the world. I want to see the worlds that authors are imagining, and I want to hear the questions they are asking. This is the Asymptote Podcast. Before we start, I just want to say that our fall 2016 issue will include our first special feature on Canadian poetry. We're looking for poetry and translation from Canadian writers across the globe, from Aboriginal writers to the newest citizens. We aim to showcase the linguistic diversity and multiculturalism that is so vital to Canada's national character. We are open to works translated from any language. In addition to French, we particularly hope to highlight First Nations, Inuit, and Métis voices. Details at asymptotejournal.com/submit. On July 20th, Asymptote member Daniel Hahn will be hosting a live version of his popular Ask a Translator column at Waterstones in London. Details can be found on the Waterstones website. Okay, so the Hugo Awards are basically the Oscars for science fiction. Named after the pioneering founder of the science fiction magazine Amazing Stories, Hugo Gernsback, the Hugos honor the very best in science fiction. Past winners include Kurt Vonnegut, Philip K. Dick, Arthur C. Clarke, and Octavia Butler. The awards are some of the most prestigious literary prizes around, yet this year, one of the titles up for consideration is Chuck Tingle's Space Raptor Butt Invasion. You can't make this stuff up. How did this happen? Well, the answer is a little complicated. Okay, it's really complicated. And it starts with a movement against diversity in video games called Gamergate. In 2013, independent game designer Zoe Quinn released a video game called Depression Quest, which was met with favorable reviews, but a vocal minority argued that she was only receiving this attention because she was a woman. I bet you can see where this is going. In the 18 months after she published Depression Quest, Quinn received a steady stream of online harassment, most of which she just tuned out. But in August of 2014, her ex-boyfriend Aaron Gjoni published the Zoe Post, a 9,425-word essay alleging that Quinn had a relationship with a video game journalist, which led to her game getting such positive reviews. Dox began receiving death threats and was doxed, which means her personal information was publicly released. One of these threats, posted on the anonymous message board 4chan, read, "Next time she shows up at a conference, we give her a crippling injury that's never going to fully heal. A good, solid injury to the knees. I'd say brain damage, but we don't want to make it so she ends up too retarded to fear us. This us called themselves Gamergate and made it their mission to protest what they saw as an unfair elevation of women and minorities in the video game community. And the movement only started to spread. Anna Sarkeesian, a blogger who critiques the portrayal of women in video games, had to cancel a public appearance because of a bomb threat. Brianna Wu, another game developer, had her address leaked and started to receive rape and death threats. Gamergate is still around. They fight against what they see as an increasing politicization of video games. I personally see them as the racist and sexist backlash to women and people of color taking leadership roles in the video game industry. So how does this relate to the Hugos? The Hugos are chosen by the members of the World Science Fiction Society, and the voting process takes place in the open, unlike, say, the Academy Awards. Over the past few years, a group calling themselves the Sad Puppies have been trying to push the Hugo Awards to nominate less political works and less works by women and writers of color. But last year, an offshoot of the Sad Puppies, the Rabid Puppies, led by a writer named Vox Day, was able to completely take over the awards ballot. Vox Day, whose real name is Theodore Beale, was nominated for the Best Short Story Award by the Sad Puppies in 2014. He came in sixth out of five authors, coming just behind no award. So the next year, in 2015, Vox Day founded the Rabid Puppies and was able to successfully hijack the ballots of numerous categories. Now, there's a lot of overlap between the Rabid Puppies and Gamergate, and their ideologies are basically the same. They find pushes for diversity misplaced, and they decry political works. At least that's what they say. In 2015, the Rabid Puppies' slate of nominees didn't get anywhere. George R. R. Martin, the author of Game of Thrones, you may have heard of him, sharply criticized their tactics, and in all five categories they hijacked, no award beat out the authors they chose. So you'd think that after their defeat, they'd go home and stop trying to push their agenda, but nope. They came back this year with a vengeance, including nominating Chuck Tingle's Space Raptor Butt Invasion for Best Short Story. Basically, they wanted to make the Hugos look like a joke. But luckily, their plan backfired. It turns out that Chuck Tingle isn't some weirdo self-published author. Well, he is, but he actually has a really devoted fan base. And on top of that, Space Raptor Butt Invasion is actually pretty funny. Here's a taste.
Over the next few days, Orion continues to come by the station and hang out. The two of us are an incredible duo, talking for hours on end about our experiences in space, or trading nostalgic stories about our homeworlds. Despite being a bloodthirsty dinosaur carnivore, Orion is actually incredibly sweet and has a truly gentle soul. The longer that we spend together, the more I find myself drawn to him, attracted, even. Our difference in species surely couldn't classify me as gay, could it? As the days turn into weeks and weeks into months, I begin to wonder if I'd even care.
Chuck Tingle is not a fan of the Rabid Puppies. After hearing of his nomination, he promptly published a short story called Slammed in the Butt by My Hugo Award Nomination and began attacking them on Twitter. He called them devilmen and said that since he must remain anonymous, if he wins, he will have Zoe Quinn accept the award for him. If you don't remember, that's totally understandable. Zoe Quinn is the one who Gamergaters first attacked. I mention all this to you because it's an argument about what science fiction does, what it's supposed to do. And the Gamergaters and the Rabid Puppies don't know the history of the genre they're claiming to defend. Science fiction, maybe more so than any other genre, is inherently political. Why? Because when you try to create a different world, you can't help but engage with the world you're already in. Are the problems that you currently face solved? Have they been exacerbated? There's a reason Ray Bradbury Mars looks like Ohio, or liberation is a constant theme in Octavia Butler's works. Science fiction gives us the ability to examine our own world while reading about others. And science fiction has never shied away from political subjects. Let's look at the short story Robot Dreams by one of the greatest science fiction authors of all time, Isaac Asimov. In it, a newly sentient robot, perhaps the smartest robot ever created, does something no robot has ever done before.
She straightened up as though determined that her own aged body was not to bow under its weight of responsibility. She said, "Alvix, do you hear me?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin,"
said the robot. "Did your dream continue? You said earlier that human beings did not appear at first. Does that mean they appeared afterward?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin. It seemed to me in my dream that eventually one man appeared."
"One man? Not a robot?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin. And the man said, 'Let my people go.'"
"The man said that?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin."
"And when he said, 'Let my people go,' then by the words 'my people,' he meant the robots?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin. So it was in my dream."
"And did you know who the man was in your dream?"
"Yes, Dr. Calvin. I knew the man."
"Who was he?" And Alvix said,
"I was the man."
And Susan Calvin at once raised her electron gun and fired, and Alvix was no more.
Asimov asks us two really important questions here. What is the definition of a person? And what do we do if expanding that definition threatens those in power? The story reflects the history of racism in the United States, and it also asks us about technology. What do we do as it rapidly advances towards an uncertain future? Will robots one day have to struggle for their own rights? It seems like a ridiculous question, but in examining it, we're forced to examine who has rights in our world. Science fiction is really interesting from a world literature perspective as well. It highlights the questions that a culture is asking, and those questions might not be present in other genres, or at least in science fiction, they take a different form. We'll start with the American author Octavia Butler, who is one of the first black women to have widespread acclaim as a science fiction author. She holds a place alongside Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke as one of the greatest authors of the genre. She is most well known for her novel Kindred, which is about a woman who travels back in time to meet her ancestors, a spoiled slave owner and a proud slave. But I really love her Patternus series, which tells the story of the painful birth of a telepathic race and their battle with an extraterrestrial invasion. It begins 500 years in the past and ends 500 years in the future. One of the books in the series, Clay's Ark, recounts the beginnings of an extraterrestrial plague. It takes place in the near future, where the rich lived in walled compounds while the poor struggle in horrific slums. And in the desert, governmental structures have completely broken down. It is here where the plague begins. Butler describes this world from the point of view of a father missing his deceased wife.
"The dream recaptured him slowly, and he could see her as she had been with the cesspool kids she taught. The kids liked her, or at least respected her. They knew she cared about them. The bigger, more troublesome ones knew she had a gun. She was too idealistic for her own good, but she was not suicidal. He saw her as she had been when he met her at UCLA. He was going to fight diseases of the body, and she, diseases of a society that seemed to her too short-sighted and indifferent to survive. She preached at him about old-fashioned, long-lost causes, human rights, the elderly, the ecology, throwaway children, corporate government, the vast rich-poor gap, and the shrinking middle class. She should have been born 20 or 30 years earlier."
Butler described herself as a black feminist, and she wrote Clay's Ark in 1984 during a conservative revival in America, not a great time for a black feminist. I really think that the description in Clay's Ark is a reflection of those times. In the 1980s, after the leftist revolutions of the 60s and 70s had petered out, America was at the height of a right-wing revival. The tax plan at the time was based upon trickle-down economics, the idea that if you make the rich richer, the poor will somehow benefit. Meanwhile, climate change was just beginning to get national attention. I don't want to give away too much of the novel, but in Clay's Ark, the extraterrestrial virus, parasite really, compels hosts to spread the disease. The story is about a group of decent people, infected, trying their best to balance their morality and their humanity against an overwhelming urge to spread the disease. There's a theory that the popular book series and even more popular television series Game of Thrones is an extended allegory for global warming. The warring kingdoms who cannot face the real threat of the White Walkers, the monsters in the north, could be paralleled to nations being unable to regulate their climate emissions. I think that Clay's Ark similarly is a metaphor for what happens when humanity gives up on egalitarianism and common decency, and instead descends into selfishness. The alien parasite in Clay's arc is like a plague sent from beyond to punish us, and our inability to act collectively dooms us. As the Soviet Union and America began the space race, like their Western counterparts, Russian authors began churning out science fiction in droves. But one author predates the space race, Sigismund Krzyzanowski, a writer who said that he was known for being unknown. Krzyzanowski's work, written in the 1920s, were much too subversive to even attempt publication. I can best describe him as a kind of dark H.G. Wells, and his short story, Memories of the Future, feels like a response to Wells' time machine. Memories of the Future is about a man named Maximilian Schrerer, who ever since he was a boy, wants to make time dance. His lineage is odd. He's the son of a wealthy German living in Russia. The short story is a sort of Bildungsroman, telling the story of Schrerer's early obsession with time and his eventual development of time travel. Schrerer is born at the end of the 19th century, and he's swept up by the political storms of the early 20th. He's taken prisoner by the Germans during World War I, and heads back to Russia after the revolution, only to find that his family's fortune has been taken by the Bolsheviks. In 1919, after a period of obscurity, he finds the financial backers to finally build his time machine. He goes into the future, as far as 1957, but technical problems force him to go back in time. He ends up in the not-so-distant future of 1928. There, a group of artists takes him in. He recounts his travels to them.
Suddenly, the linguist, extending an obliging flame, broke his 26-language silence. One question. May I? Schrerer glanced over his shoulder and nodded. He was listening. The novelist, having inserted his right arm into the sleeve of his coat, let drop his left and waited. Two or three people paused by the door. My question is this. There's a certain discrepancy, or so at least it seems to me, between the duration of your sojourn in ahead of time, let's say, and the quantity of ordinary vulgar time that elapsed while you, I realize that T and T speak different languages, but even so, how did you manage it? Absolutely right. In his bewilderment, Schrerer took a step towards the gauntlet of words. How did I manage it? That question has tormented me for days. Needless to say, measuring T inside T isn't easy. My calculations make me think that I may not have managed it, that my meeting with real time may never have occurred. My machine could have been destroyed by a less serious obstacle. And that I am among ghosts, forgive me, engendered by ghostly durations. I have tried to express myself as simply as possible and as politely. And I was pleased just now with my hypothesis about tea banging into tea. But if this hypothesis doesn't satisfy you, then we may suppose that my machine never managed to reach reality, that it crashed into the shadow cast ahead by tea time. And my sense of the people now surrounding me is that they are people without a now, people whose present has been left behind, people with projected wills, with words resembling the ticking clocks wound long before, with lives faint as the impression under the 10th sheet of carbon. Then again, a third hypothesis is also possible. I, Maximilian Schrerer, am a madman who's denied, even in a straitjacket, and everything I've told you is nonsense, gibberish. I sincerely advise you to embrace this last point of view, the most profitable, solid and comforting of the three.
His entire life, Schrerer has never cared about politics, yet it has interfered with his dreams. His dream of time travel is much more important to him than war or revolutions. He's searching for an ideal, yet he only ends up in a world of shadows. We can see Schrerer as a metaphor for the artist in the Soviet Union, or really any politically repressive regime. In a totalitarian world, even the apolitical pursuit of beauty is crushed by the state, which demands conformity. Perhaps we can even see Schrerer's obscurity, his brilliance, as a metaphor for Krzyzanowski himself. Schreier is always talking about his plans. Large portions of the story are indecipherable technobabble, yet you know that he's on to something. At the end of the story, a Soviet functionary visits Schreier, then he disappears. We never find out if it's because he finally rebuilt his time machine, or if there are more mundane causes for his disappearance. At the end of the story, we ask ourselves, did Schreier find what he was looking for? Will he ever? African science fiction faces a lot of unique challenges that other science fictions don't. Nigerian-American author Nnedi Okpuranta discusses them in her essay, African Science Fiction is Still Alien. She discusses the idea that African authors may be dissuaded from writing science fiction. She says, Things Fall Apart was one of the first African novels to garner critical acclaim overseas due to colonialism. Success overseas is the hallmark of an African writer's success. This great work was one of the first African novels to enter standard university curricula globally. Nevertheless, this also set a precedent for African writers striving to be viewed as serious writers. Even today, many African writers still dismiss genre fiction like science fiction and fantasy as childish or amateur. The idea that science fiction and fantasy is somehow childish or amateur persists in the West as well, but the West has nearly 100 years of great writers who disprove this idea. Okpuranta is trying to disprove this idea herself by writing science fiction works set in Africa. One of her novels, Lagoon, tells the story of an alien invasion that begins in Lagos, Nigeria. By setting the invasion in Lagos, instead of New York or London, she makes the Nigerian city a focal point. Her novel begins from the point of view of a swordfish who encounters the alien being in the waters outside of Lagos.
Now here in her home was something even wilder and more alive than her lost paradise. And like there, the water here was sweet, clean and clear. She couldn't see the end of it. However, there was one thing she was certain of. What she was seeing wasn't from the sea's greatest depths or the dry places. This was from far, far away. More and more creatures swam down to it. As they drew closer, she saw the colors pulsate and embrace them. She noticed an octopus with one missing tentacle descending toward it. Suddenly, it grew brilliant pink purple and straightened all its tentacles. Then, right before her eyes, it grew its missing tentacle back, and what looked like bony spokes erupted from its soft head. It spun and flipped and then shot off, down into one of the circular bone-like caves of the undulating coral-like thing below. When a golden blob ascended to meet her, she still didn't move, but she didn't flee either. The sweetness she smelled and its gentle movements were soothing and non-threatening. When it communicated with her, asking question after question, she hesitated. Then she told it exactly what she wanted. Everything was changing. She'd always loved her smooth skin, but now it became impenetrable, its color now golden like the light the new people gave off. The color that reminded her of another life where she could both enjoy the water and endure the sun and the air. Her sword-like spear grew longer and so sharp at the tip that it sang. They made her eyes like the blackest stone, and she could see deep into the ocean and high into the sky. And when she wanted to, she could make spikes of cartilage jut out along her spine, as if she were some ancestral creature from the deepest ocean caves of old. The last thing she requested was to be 3 times her size and 2x her weight. They made it so. Now, she was no longer a great swordfish. She was a monster. Despite the FPSO Maestra's loading hose leaking crude oil, the ocean water just outside of Lagos, Nigeria was now so clean that a cup of its salty, sweet goodness would heal the worst human illnesses and cause 100 more illnesses yet known to humankind. It was more alive than it had been in centuries, and it was teeming with aliens and monsters.
One more.
The novel shows how the people of Lagos deal with the sudden appearance of aliens in their waters. It doesn't try to paint a positive or negative portrait of the city. It instead just tries to show the city as it is, the good and the bad. Okparanta mixes African magical realism with a good old-fashioned alien invasion to create a science fiction that is uniquely African. She's asking us, what would this world look like? She finishes her article by saying, as African consumers sample the few works out available, their palates will grow accustomed to and hopefully even crave homegrown African-rooted science fiction. It's only a matter of time. I can imagine what will come next. Latin America has a nearly 150-year tradition of science fiction, although regrettably, very little of that has been translated into English. Luckily, that's starting to change. One author who's being translated into English is Cuban author Ángel Arango. Arango can be considered the founder of Cuban science fiction, and his work sticks to a number of ideals, namely non-aggression. He says that this approach is an extreme position and a challenge for a writer, but the result is incredibly good. I can see where he's coming from. Part of the problem with the Rabid Puppies is that their idea of good science fiction revolves around future space empires shooting lasers at each other. That's not a particularly revolutionary literary form. By imagining a future of non-aggression, Arango challenges himself to create better, more imaginative stories. We can see this in his 1964 short story, The Cosmonaut.
The man's boldness grew as he saw himself a king before all those creatures who remained immobile, analyzing him through their many tentacles filled with cerebral spheres, thousands of thinking eyes upon the man, scrutinizing him, penetrating him, taking stock of his image and movements, taking possession of his shape. He entered the blue dust. The others saw how comfortably he moved on his feet, observing everything and emitting a constant series of sparks between his brows. Speak to him, Mutt suggested. Say something, anything. Who are you? Git asked. The cosmonaut did not hear anything. His glass helmet continued to throw off sparks between his brows, but he had a feeling they wanted to have a conversation. The best he could do was emit more sparks, this time blue. Git, Nui, Mutt, and the others understood them to be a symbol of peace. His words are blue like our dust, said Mutt. He wants to tell us something. I wonder why he's so small, Nui asked. Git signaled. He has two twin brains that shine. He opens and closes them. Look carefully. And above his brains, he speaks to us with words of blue light. Yes, said Nui. How old do you think he is? He must be very young, Mutt speculated. His tentacles are short. Nui faced the man. Come closer, she said to him. Closer. The cosmonaut heard absolutely nothing. Then Nui approached him. Are you alone? Are there no others with you? The others looked toward the outer door of the ship, which had been left open. But no one else appeared. One of the tentacle children dashed over to the stairs and ran up them. The man, who had seen it, continued trying to start a conversation. They're playful and peaceful, he told himself. The little ones look like puppies. And indeed, the little ones were the ones who drew closest in order to look at him. I've caused a stir, the man went on thinking. Mutt asked, what must his children be like? And he subdivided, so the visitor could understand what he was talking about. Nui, observing him from close by, saw that he looked like Git, though his tentacles lacked brains. He's so young that he doesn't yet have any, she said to herself. Then Nui let herself be carried away by curiosity, more than by the desire to procreate, and she cut the man's arms with her pincers. Chuck, chuck. While bleeding to death, the cosmonaut felt he was running out of air, and the last thing that he heard was, again, chuck, 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 chuck.
First of all, just because Arango doesn't write aggression doesn't mean that there can't be violence or conflict. In The Cosmonaut, the violence and conflict comes from misunderstanding. Arango wrote this story only 5 years after the Cuban Revolution, when a brave new world was opening up for Cuba, and only 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when a conflict between two peoples who could communicate nearly led to a nuclear war. The story shows the difficulty of communication and just how easily you can hurt someone, even when you have the best intentions. Think about the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union certainly did not have good intentions towards each other, and the difficulty becomes staggering. Arango is asking us, how do we communicate? And the ending of his story doesn't give us a clear answer. For people who claim to be defending science fiction, I think the rabbit puppies have a really narrow view of the genre. Ironically enough, it's the same view that the woman at the party had, space battles and landing platforms, but that's certainly not what the genre is about. Clearly, the genre runs deeper than that. Avery Brooks, the actor who played a captain in Star Trek, has a great quote about why he took a chance on the series, and I think it can be applied to science fiction as a whole. He says, "It was to give a single child a chance to see the long thought, to see themselves some 400 years hence. It occurred to me that we must ensure that we keep in front of children the ever-changing horizon, to let the children know that there is possibility, to let the children know that someone is not going to take away or destroy this world before they have a chance. We have to keep that in front of them." When world literature grows, it thrives. Each language and culture brought into the fold makes the idea that much richer. Yet, if this world literature project is going to succeed, it's going to need not just a diversity of languages and cultures, but a diversity of genres as well. And if you still don't think science fiction is literary, I'll leave you with an excerpt from Italo Calvino's short story, The Dinosaur, about the last living dinosaur seeing his son for the first time. "I waited for him in a clearing of the woods to watch him play, chase a butterfly, slam a pine cone against a stone to dig out the pine nuts. I went over. It was my son, all right. He looked at me curiously. 'Who are you?' he asked. 'Nobody,' I said. 'What about you? Do you know who you are?' 'What a question. Everybody knows that. I'm a new one,' he said." That was exactly what I had expected to hear him say. I patted his head, said, "Good for you," and went off. I traveled through valleys and plains. I came to a station, caught the first train, and was lost in the crowd. Special thanks to our audio editor, Mirza Puritz, our readers, Pieli Sham, Alessio Franco, and Ron Carahota. The Cosmonaut was translated by Andrea Bell, The Dinosaur by William Weaver, and Memories of the Future by Joanne Turnbull. The Prelude to Lagoon can be found in the anthology Afro Sci-Fi, Science Fiction by African Writers, edited by Ivor Hartman. And The Cosmonaut can be found in the anthology Cosmos Latinos, edited by Andrea Bell and Yolanda Molina Gavilan. You can find links to the Amazon pages of all the works read in this episode at asymptotejournal.com/blog/podcast. We're back in August. We hope to see you then.